ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Artemis 2 has flown round the moon, and the four astronauts on board are on their way home.
Today, for all humanity, you're pushing beyond that frontier.
We're following every step of the mission in a special daily season of science fiction called Artemis Explained. Stay with us as the mission continues to unfold, with updates from me, Belinda Smith, so you know what just happened and why it matters.
Integrity, over to you.
Search for science fiction on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has confirmed his upcoming trip to Singapore as the government continues to build resilience, as it puts it, amid all this global uncertainty. He's also indicated that this year's budget will be quite late in being finalised. It comes as the US president has once again criticised Australia and NATO allies for their lack of help, as his deadline for Iran to agree to a ceasefire or face complete demolition looms. And as instability continues to hit markets and weigh on people's sentiment, Treasurer Jim Chalmers is trying to put the final touches on his fifth budget. The Treasurer, of course, is telling us that it's going to be his most ambitious in terms of reform, but as the spending pressures compound, can we really hold him to his word? Or does this global backdrop mean they get back to basics like keeping the economy afloat rather than long-term themes? Welcome to Politics Now. I'm Jacob Grieber, and once again, in the chair for Patricia.
And I'm Tom Crowley. We sit next to each other in the office, Jacob, but, you know, I don't think we have ever been beside one another on any sort of ABC product, so it's good to be with you.
This will either end in tears or go very well.
It may never happen again.
Here's hoping. Look, we'll get to the budget, because I think that's still, well, I think it's increasingly now becoming the number one issue in Canberra in terms of the political debate. It's just part of the cycle. Every year you sort of have the Easter holidays and then everyone's mind switches to the budget, which starts to become really... Governments have to make big calls at this point of the cycle. There's a myth that the budget's sort of finalised on the last weekend. I always laugh when lobby groups put out a press release on the Monday demanding that item X, Y, and Z be included in the budget 12 hours later. It's just not how it works. The big stuff's happening really as we speak. This week and next week and the week after is when these really tough decisions get made. Now, before we get to that, the Prime Minister has just been on his feet in the Prime Minister's courtyard. It's part of really a daily dose of communication from the government. We've been seeing this now for well over a week from the Prime Minister. We had Chris Bowen up yesterday, the Prime Minister up today, once again going through the nitty-gritty of the fuel supply situation, how many Bowsers are shut, how many are open. It's very reminiscent of COVID to my mind.
You're not allowed to say that, Jacob. It's not weird. It's not COVID.
It is so COVID. Then it was all about the number of positive diagnoses. Now it's all about how many Bowsers have run dry. Anyway, the good news is that there's been another decline in the number of empty Bowsers around the country. And he's also confirmed he's off to Singapore later this week, where he will be meeting his counterpart. That is being portrayed as a sensible, steady thing to be doing, shoring up agreements with important countries that deliver a lot of the liquid fuels that we rely on. Tom, are you expecting anything concrete out of this visit? What's your take of the importance of this trip?
Maybe not necessarily anything concrete, but gee, these bilateral relationships are really important at the moment. I think whether the Prime Minister's feeling smug about very much at the moment. I mean, these crises can catch you unawares for things that you might have spent more time on. But the amount of time that he has spent engaging in the region and the focus that the government has put on this really since the election of the Albanese government has been, you know, really significant. And as he likes to say, it means now I can pick up the phone. When the rubber hits the road, though, that gets a little bit more difficult. We're in this position where so many of the East Asian markets that we rely on for our fuel, they're scrambling to figure out where they can get their crude. The answer's often a very angry Donald Trump's America and also Mexico. And at the moment, all the way through April and into May, Chris Bowen says we're all right for fuel. We've got these contracts signed. But it's when things get a little hairier. It's when their supply of crude starts to dry up and they have to make difficult decisions about which of their usual customers they can continue to serve. That's really where these sorts of smile and wave tours, if that's all this turns out to be, are really, really important for just having a plan of attack for how they're going to navigate that. Because in a sense, it's oil company to oil company that these sorts of commercial arrangements are worked out. But really, it's government to government and leader to leader relationships that will matter at the moment for just the simple supply chain management questions the longer this war goes on.
Yeah, it's not so much that we think that we won't be able to buy fuel, that the suppliers in Australia that go into the global market to secure diesel, avgas, you name it, whatever it might be, crude oil that then gets shipped here and converted into what we need. It's not so much that fear, I think. I think it's the concern that if this crisis continues to go on, continues to deteriorate, there will come a moment when some of these countries will have to prioritise their own people, their own economies, their own livelihoods over Australia, given Australia is sort of down the line. Do you think that anxiety is overblown? Am I getting that wrong? Or do you think that actually that's really what the Prime Minister's trying to get ahead of? He can then eyeball various leaders around the region and say, well, we gave each other undertakings that we'd have each other's back here.
Yeah, I think that is a key part of it for the Prime Minister. And, you know, I just think it's sort of a day-by-day and week-by-week proposition. The more frequently and the deeper into this war that he can continue to have those conversations, and especially with the theatrics of an actual visit to Singapore, the better off that it'll be. Japan seems to be the one at the moment that there's been particular or at least visibility of some strain in that relationship. I think with Singapore and Malaysia in particular so far, it's all been happy campers. But Japan seemed to get a little bit skittish when we were hearing here speculation about a gas windfall tax. They didn't like that idea. They don't like the idea of being surprised by something like that. And this sort of tough talk from Anthony Albanese and others in the government to Japan saying, well, we're a very reliable supplier of your gas, subtext. We really hope you'll be a reliable supplier of, in particular, diesel. I think we get 7% of our diesel from Japan. So they're not top of the list, but everyone's important at this stage.
There's actually sort of an asymmetry there, isn't there? If in the relationship between Australia and Japan, if we're talking pure energy terms, yes, 9% of our diesel, or 7%, I'm not sure what the number is, it's a single-digit percentage number, comes from Japan. But a city like Tokyo, the lights literally go out if there's no Australian gas. It's something like 30% of Japan's energy comes in the form of LNG. It's a huge number. And they're right at this critical moment in time where their other preferred supplier in the Middle East is now in dire straits. That source of supply, if you read some of the analysis that's around, is not going to be turned on the minute the war's over. It's actually going to take years to rebuild these gas trains. So Japan's in quite a diabolical situation on this energy question. And we're seeing reports out of the Japanese media that indeed the Japanese Prime Minister is planning a trip here very, very soon. And I mean, she's apparently a punk rock drummer, and I'd imagine she's going to be bringing some of that energy to her meeting with the Prime Minister.
Well, they might bond over that. I think when Giorgia Meloni visited Japan, there was singing, so I don't know whether maybe, and she's also gotten behind the drum kit with the South Korean leader, so maybe we'll have a musical installment. No Pearl Harbor references, though, I'm sure, when she visits Anthony Albanese. He'll be right. A little bit more tactful than Donald Trump was.
No, yeah, that was quite the scene when Donald Trump brought that up. But no, now you've got me thinking about Tony Burke on bass, Albo on
guitar. Oh, don't suggest it. Don't give them any ideas.
Or maybe the triangle. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what his musical abilities are beyond DJing. Anyway, the point is some of these relationships are going to get quite tested if this crisis continues. And Japan, of course, feels that particularly gas that comes out of Darwin, the Ichthys, I don't know if I quite said that right, so it was an awkward name to say, that gas has essentially been made available because of an enormous Japanese investment, direct investment. It's actually the single biggest foreign investment by any Japanese company outside of Japan. So they have quite a sort of, I wouldn't use the word proprietorial, but they have a real sense that it's been made possible by their capital. So any threat to that is deeply sensitive for the Japanese.
And it's all also, I think, a really important stress test for how all of these Asian relationships, and including us in that, might go with any sort of conflict closer to our region. Obviously, the one that everyone always talks about and thinks about is the question of Taiwan. I think the question of whether these relationships, which on paper, under no strain, have looked really positive for Australia, I think in our region over the last few years under the Albanese government, now that there is just a little bit of discomfort, really acute domestic pressure because of an international crisis that everyone is having to navigate, can we remain friendly with all of these countries throughout a period like this? I think that that will be watched closely by everyone who, you know, plans out what scenarios might look like if there is a conflagration in our region.
I mean, what you don't want is a sort of Hunger Games scenario where whoever has the biggest checkbook, secures the fuels that they need at the expense of others. And I think, you know, Australia is, yes, we don't quite have the sort of budget flexibility that we had, for instance, during the global financial crisis or even before COVID. We do have more debt, but we've got a lot of fiscal firepower as a, you know, as a country, as a government. We sell a lot of commodities that can help boost national income, that we can tax and that we can then deploy. So a country like the Philippines or even Indonesia, where fuels are often heavily subsidized by those governments, it's direct government-on-government economic violence, in a sense, if we just come in with the biggest checkbook, buy whatever we need for our needs, when you actually end up with much poorer countries, developing countries, struggling to secure their own supplies. I can see this becoming really a big source of tension if it continues.
And that's where Australia has already been asked a couple of questions about whether they would help out the Pacific nations, and the general sense is we would try to do right by them. But it's exactly what the IEA is, you know, desperately warning every country not to do at the moment, is to just sort of turn inward. I think those comments particularly directed at China, but they're saying to everyone, look, you know, don't. You know, you almost get kind of a global version of the panic buying that we're seeing domestically as countries try to shore up their own supplies.
And they're all under the same amount or more political pressure as any government is. So, yeah, that's potentially a very risky place. Now, speaking of allies or speaking of like-minded or friendly countries, let's talk about Donald Trump. And every morning we wake up and there's some new wild headline out there. I think the most substantive thing is that this deadline that he's imposed, I think it's about the third one now, the timelines always change, but the one the world seems to be operating on now is the one that runs out tomorrow or Wednesday this week at about 10 a.m.
Tuesday US time, Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday. Oh, killer line there. Trump always chickens out.
We'll see.
He's there's a lot of bellicose language coming out from the president in the last few hours. Iran can be taken out in one night, he says, with a complete demolition of their energy and bridges and power plants. Quite sort of bombastic, extreme language. Is that just a ploy or does Iran look through it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the rhetoric had already been dialed up to such an extraordinary degree that when Trump tries the shock and awe strategy that I think he really likes as a way of trying to force people's hands in negotiation is this sort of big threat. They're having to get louder and swearier as time goes on. Notably, so far, he's been making them outside of US market hours. So there's something interesting in that. We'll see what happens. You may be able to be discussing this already by the time you do the podcast tomorrow. But he did give us a mention as well. We need a whiteboard day since Donald Trump has mentioned us in a Truth Social post, and we'll be wiping it out every few days.
Just for those who haven't paid attention or aren't able to read the press, what's the line today?
Well, once again, it was the lack of help in the Strait of Hormuz. And every time that he mentions this, he's frustrated at all of his allies, NATO allies, but Japan, South Korea and Australia have been included on that list before. And he mentioned us again. It was just sort of a Japan didn't help, South Korea didn't help, Australia didn't help.
So help when we weren't asked or brought into the tent, as it were.
Or even necessarily had a vessel that could have helped. Yeah. But yes, that's right. And the government's line is, as you say, We weren't consulted. This is not our war. It's not reasonable, essentially, to expect us to help. But that kind of frustration,
I think actually, just a short time ago, the Prime Minister said And I thought there's a bit of nuance here. Yet again asked about how, his frustrations about the war, how long it's going. He said, well, the sooner it's over, the better, words to that effect. But then he also said we weren't involved or supportive of the war in its first instance. Now, that jars a little bit with what they said. Within hours of the assault on Tehran beginning, the government, the Australian government, backed the Americans, the decapitation strategy as it was then seen, and to get rid of the nuclear threat. But the language has really changed now, hasn't it?
Yeah, we were supportive but not involved. But now, you know, you really couldn't even consider us to be that. Certainly, you're not going to get a repeat of the kinds of lines that we had in the first week of the crisis, which was, you know, supportive broadly of the US war aims, although always a little skeptical about regime change. We just now sound like we're over the whole thing. I mean, in some ways, it sounds like Donald Trump's over the whole thing, but he can't quite figure out how to land the plane. So, look, you know, it's a position now, I think, where the sum total of US allies, even acting in concert, it's not clear whether any of us are able to exert any influence over the US administration to bring this to an end. We're really just, you know, almost reduced to a commentator or, you know, urging, hoping that it ends as soon as possible.
And the government, of course, is the talking point is we won't be commenting on the daily twists and turns of whatever the president says. It does strike me, though, that the atmospherics are a little different now than, say, a year ago. If the president had said something like he said a few hours ago, that Australia didn't help us, and the tone in his voice, it's worth listening. It's quite, it's almost whiny. It's quite aggressively angry about Australia and the other allies. If he'd said that a year ago, I think there'd be a full-blown internal Australian political debate about, is the relationship broken? Are we doomed? Are we no longer special in America? Today, it sounds like laughable stuff. It sort of doesn't have the weight that it once might have had.
I think that's true. Although even a year ago, and I think particularly during the election campaign, we were already there to a point. I mean, I think we had a conversation about the government's relationship with the US government, but I think a lot of the general public seemed to send a message. They didn't like Donald Trump. They didn't really blame the Albanese government very much even back then for any of his utterances. They didn't like any suggestion of closeness or similarity between Trump and Peter Dutton. I think that has just deepened as the crisis, this war has gone on, but as the rolling, sprawling show of the Trump administration's gone on as well. I just think the public thinks and understands, well, how could anyone have a normal relationship with this administration?
Yeah, it's going to be fun to watch that. And I think the opposition's ability to make hay out of that is limited as well, because every time one of these hits comes from Donald Trump on Australia, I feel like it actually... There's a sort of Team Australia response to it in a funny sort of way, and that wasn't the case, you know, a year ago, 18 months ago. So that's a dramatic shift. So look, the other interesting thing I think that we heard from the Prime Minister was his discussion around the budget. And you're a fellow like me who's read a lot of budgets. You've been in a lot of lockups. Put yourself in the shoes of the Treasurer. And tell me, how would you be doing this in these circumstances where some of the forecasts are, depending on how bleak you think this is, are not helpful for forming a budget? Like, we've got very high inflation, maybe. We've got a large hit to GDP growth. We might even have a productivity hit here as well. How do you form a budget? How do you frame up a budget in this kind of totally unpredictable scenario?
Well, I think it is worth starting by saying that's really difficult and I'm glad I don't have to do it. I mean, it is a constantly changing, it's a really difficult set of economic forecasts for Treasury to do. I think the reason that the Prime Minister earlier today and Jim Chalmers all along have been emphasising that the budget will be finalised really, really close to the deadline is because Treasury will be running their forecast rounds more frequently than they usually do. The enormous amount of uncertainty in those forecasts, you know, I mean, what is the central scenario here? Is there a tipping point that you want to identify in your forecasts where if the war goes on past a certain point and you think we head into a really sort of darker territory in a global sense? All of that affects the political appetite that you're going to have in the budget. It affects what your numbers are going to look like. it affects whether you're handing down a budget in what already by May may look like a recession. We're not sure whether it will or not, but that's how quickly and dramatically things are unfolding. A recession where you also have elevated inflation is a totally nightmarish scenario for any treasurer to be handing down a budget, but most of all, a budget that was framed and is still being framed as the most ambitious and important of the Albanese government.
They're really hanging on to that. And again this morning, also in the last few days, that sense of the government saying, look, now is the time to do bolder things because it's looking quite fraught out there. Does that really work in reality?
I don't know. I mean, the phrase that's getting thrown around a lot at the moment is never waste a crisis. And I think that there is something in that. You can use these moments as an opportunity to be bolder than you would otherwise. But is the public really going to understand the link between a war and the need to be bolder on something like capital gains tax and the housing market or the NDIS? Is there a link in people's minds between the idea that global instability makes it more important to do those things? I don't know. You're right.
And all of those things involve somehow taking away something.
They're not
taking
popular.
Something off the table. You're denying people an entitlement or a tax break that they've had.
Yeah.
For a greater good, a broader purpose, but you're doing it at a time of crisis.
Yeah, and this was, I guess, if we're kind of mourning the budget that might have been or trying to understand what the budget might have been if this war didn't break out, it was going to be, we think, a really tough, unpopular budget. This was the year in the middle of a cycle where you've won 94 seats, where it seemed like the government decided, all right, now's the time to get a little bit ugly. On the spending side, that seems to mean not necessarily changing the NDIS growth target, which has been at 5% per year, this growth target for a while now, which is roughly halving the sort of growth that Labor inherited, but maybe getting down to brass tacks a little bit about exactly where that money is going to come from and how you're going to achieve it.
That involves taking away.
The public service as well, 5% efficiency drive that was there. And then this question about the intergenerational tax stuff, which might be a positive sell to younger voters. But again, as you say, it's about taking away.
Mm. I've been picking up in the last, let's say, 24, 36 hours, I would call it a sort of mixed perception of our situation. And on the one hand, Australia is really quite well placed by global standards. Citigroup put out some research over the weekend that ranked the hit to various economies from this energy shock. And there's really only three economies in the world where growth might actually go up as a result of them being strong energy exporters. At number three is the United States. And one of the arguments for why Donald Trump is so cavalier about this war is that he's sort of shielded from the direct energy impact. The US produces an extraordinary amount of energy, far more than it did, for instance, during the Second Gulf War. So it can withstand that more than others. The other one, the number one economy in the world is Canada, and in number two is Australia. And this goes to what we were talking about earlier about the gas exports. So as a country, we're not actually this destitute lost cause where we're at the whims of whatever happens. We actually have quite a lot of economic agency. Now, I've been testing...
Doesn't feel like it, though, but that's always...
But that's what I think's interesting. So I've been testing that with people in the government. And frankly, I get more anxiety back than I do about any sort of positive sense that Australia does have levers to pull, it does have agency here. Now, I'm not saying this is all pleasant and fun. It's not. This is in the context of things going very, very bad. But it's not the end of the world because Australia does have these resiliences.
But it comes in a context, I think, where, even by the end of the last term of the Albanese government, the actually acute cost of living pressures were really starting to ease. Real wages were starting to catch up again. When you look at households, yes, they sustained higher wage rises. There weren't really very many distressed sales. There wasn't a particular spike in people going into arrears. People weren't really eating into their savings. Australia, you could argue, weathered the cost of living crisis really well, but the voter anger was still totally febrile and the government was taking no chances about it. And so I was always a little bit sceptical even when inflation started to pick up at the beginning of this year, about whether this government would buck the trend of governments for as long as I've been following budgets, or really since maybe in the last decade at least, let's say, and do something genuinely unpopular for any segment of the population. They were talking up the fact that they might use their political capital to tackle intergenerational tax reform and to get tougher on spending. I was curious to see, and I think I can say hopeful to see, some reckoning with the structural budget challenges that I've been harping on about for a really long time, but I was a little bit sceptical. I'm sort of more sceptical now. They continue to say it in the last few days, so it's interesting. That obviously means something, that they are still saying that they want to be ambitious, but whether that could really just melt down to tinkering. I just thought the shift on the fuel excise last week, the fact that so quickly, when any hint of a cost of living wedge between Angus Taylor and the Prime Minister opened up, it was just snapped down like that. That just suggests to me that the old rules of politics apply, that even if on paper Australia is better placed to weather this than others, that...
Well, look, politics requires you to be seen to be taking action as a government. The fuel excise, I think, is a quintessential example of that, isn't it? If it gets worse, if it deteriorates and lingers, we seem to be okay for April, but there's a big question mark over May. It's an unanswerable question, really, because we have to see what happens abroad. But governments are still required in a crisis to act. Do we have an ability to act, or is it really that bereft?
I think that we have an ability to act. I guess it depends on, again, whether you're talking about an ability to act to shield Australians through this, where I think that pretty much all of the measures available to us are either now being done or being considered. But acting to kind of fix the fundamentals, to fix the budget balance or the productivity problem, the things that the government knows, if you can't fix particularly productivity coming out of this crisis, where are we going to get growth from? Where are we going to get the propulsion in living standards that makes people actually feel better about their economic situation? Is this a time where those arguments are easier to make and where risks are easier to take? Or will the public just want a budget that's focused on the short term and here's what we're doing about this crisis and we're showing you the confidence that we are doing something? I think that is the question that will be debated around the cabinet table probably this week.
And it's so tough for them to actually make this call. When do you make the call? You can't make it on the morning of the budget. You have to make it earlier than that. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to bet too much, but I'd almost eat this computer in front of me if those budget forecasts turn out to be accurate. It's just the nature of it. They're going to make a guess. They're going to take their best shot at it. But in the circumstances such as these, you can almost be sure they'll be off the mark. Listen, just one more really quick thing before we wrap up today. We're keeping track, of course, of this by-election in Farrah. That was Susan Lee's seats vacated. Really interesting contest between One Nation and an independent, Michelle Millthorpe. Interesting news from our colleague and friend of the podcast, Claire Armstrong, reporting that quite a nice pot of money seems to have landed in Michelle Millthorpe's campaign from an unexpected source.
An unexpected source, the son-in-law, no less, of Rupert Murdoch, who is a regenerative farmer. His name is Alistair McLeod. We don't know how much he has given to Michelle Millthorpe's campaign because we don't yet have the real-time disclosures that are in these new laws that Don Farrell passed in the last parliament.
That was just another bit of news, by the way, that went past us, that they've delayed this by about 6 months. Farrah is actually the reason the Electoral Commission using for why. They can't get their systems in place. They sort of indicated the systems aren't robust enough to handle this change. So that's been kicked out. So, yeah, again, we're flying a little blind as voters on who's funding who. But really interesting development, money coming into Millthorpe. I think it's still one of the most fascinating campaigns, by-elections that are out there.
Absolutely. And look, I can see why Anthony Albanese decided that the best spot for him was a spectator seat in this one. I think he'd be quite happy to watch the Nats, the Libs, One Nation duke it out with an independent.
That's it. Listen, that's it for politics now today. Thanks, Tom, so much for joining me.
Thanks, Jacob. It's been fun.
It has. And tomorrow I'll be joined by David Spears. And if you have a question for us, please send a short voice note to theparty room@abc.net.au. See you later, Tom.
See ya.